supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Teenagers and young adults experimenting with drugs and alcohol is fairly common, very common. Parental anxiety around this is universal. For most, this is a worrisome phase of development, and the experimentation doesn't amount to much. But all of us know families where this was more than just a phase and becomes a lifelong problem. On today's show, we want to look at what's commonplace when kids are first introduced, when they first tried it, when they will try it again and again. We want to take a clear-eyed look at the issue of youth and alcohol. We'll talk about what's normal, what's average, what's acceptable, what's realistic, and what's not, and most important, what's a parent to do. For this, I've got three guests, Kathleen Myers, Tisha Miller, and Hugh Gusterson. Kathleen Myers and Tisha Miller are from the Treatment Research Institute here in Philadelphia. Kathleen's a senior researcher and leader in the assessment and treatment of adolescent substance abuse disorders. Kathy, welcome.
Great to be here.
And Tisha's a social worker and a family specialist within the Institute's family training program. Tish, welcome.
Thank you.
And both of those ladies join us here in the studio. Hugh Gusterson's a professor of anthropology and sociology at George Mason University. He's the co-conductor of the 2010 study called Understanding Teen Drinking Cultures in America. We've reached Hugh by phone in Bethesda. Hugh, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Dan.
And, of course, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. What discussions have you had with your children about alcohol use or your young adult, and what discussions have you avoided? 888-477-9499. Hugh, let's start with you. Your study was really interesting. Most studies look at problem drinkers and trends and why they do and why they do it and how we can change them. Yours was just about understanding the culture.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of studies tend to operate from survey data, and we found that teenagers told us that they're often deceptive when they answer survey questions. So our main method actually was to convene focus groups of teenagers in different places around the country. We did 59 different focus groups with teenagers and tried to get them to talk in a fairly relaxed way about what drinking meant to them. And one of the things that we found by doing that is that different kinds of teens have very different relationships to drinking. So some teens basically don't drink at all. We call these abstainers. Some teens, who we call partiers, drink quite heavily, and then there are more moderate drinkers that we call social drinkers in the study.
You also have a category of group called the losers. Are these roles fixed? Do kids who are social drinkers remain social drinkers, or do they get worse or better?
Great question. The losers in particular are not a fixed group, and I want to emphasize that by losers we don't mean alcoholics. Losers are people who tend to ruin a party. They don't understand how the body metabolizes alcohol. They drink far too much too quickly. They mix drinks, and so they end up throwing up, getting in a situation where people are worried that they might have to call an ambulance or call adults. And so they ruin the party for everyone, and other teens think of them as losers in that context. So often young drinkers who are just starting out might find themselves in that role for a few parties, and it's a very unpleasant role to be in because other people gossip about you in an unpleasant kind of way. So most teens tend to move out of that role pretty quickly. The abstainers tend to stay in the abstainer role as far as we can see, but some kids who start out drinking heavily, as they get a little older and more mature, may move into that more moderate drinking category. So one of the most hopeful aspects of our study, I think, was the idea that teens can learn to moderate their drinking over time and move to a less dangerous role, or even to an abstaining role.
Your research tells us that teens who occupy these different roles, they often socialize together. So let's talk about peer pressure as one moves into a more dangerous role or out of one.
Well, I think one of the most interesting and unexpected things we found actually is the role of the abstainers, the people who don't drink at all. What we had expected on the basis of the literature is that they would be sort of the skunks at the party, that they would be ruining the festivities for other people, and there'd be a lot of pressure on them to join in and to drink. And what we saw in these focus groups we did is that people who admitted that they drank a lot would point to someone else on the other side of the room and say, but he doesn't drink at all. And often the person who didn't drink was quite reasonably well accepted as a part of the group. It wasn't as if they were an outcast or anything. And the teens talked about the abstainers actually being useful at the parties. Teens have, to some degree, got the message about the dangers of mixing, drinking, and driving. And so it's useful to have someone at a party who doesn't drink, who can then drive people home afterwards. Mm. So we found something that we hadn't quite expected, that abstainers do have a valued role within this cultural setting.
That's changed. That's clearly changed. I mean, from my youth, when, you know, people abstained, and, you know, on the occasional party when I abstained, you know, I remember getting a lot of pressure, people telling me I was bringing everybody down. So it's nice to hear that that's changed over the years. Kathleen, Kathy, tell us about the difference between peer influence and parental influence here. Who's got more power?
That's a great question. Both have a lot of power. What you're seeing today is that kids look to their parents for information on major life issues, substance use being one. And so parental opinion, parental provision, parental attitudes toward drinking really set the stage for whether a youth will be able to moderate their drinking or perhaps not drink at all. Peers, on the other hand, exert a lot of influence on day-to-day activities, clothes, where they're going to go. And it's important then that parents know the peer group and even the peer group's family so that they get a really good idea of how is my son's peer group or my daughter's peer group going to interface with him or her, and how do my rules fit into that so that they really can begin a good discussion on that. Let me say one thing about the social drinkers. You know, there certainly are these categories, as you has mentioned, and he's done a really interesting study. I want to say that for those of your listeners, if you think your child is a social drinker, that doesn't mean they're out of the woods. And what you see in the literature is that adolescents drink much more than adults in one sitting. And because of their physiology, it is highly likely that they don't experience the same effects. So you don't see as much falling down, passing out, which means they drink more and more, which can lead to alcohol poisoning. So whether or not an individual can move between these groups is important, but also within a group, there are risks because binge drinking is really, really common among this age period.
Yeah, I know, and it's a serious problem. I wonder if, Hugh, do you have any information about these kids who move from social drinkers or from partiers to social drinkers, who kind of move up the ladder, for lack of a better word? Do we know anything about them?
I think I wish I understood it in more detail than I do, so it's more of an impressionistic than a completely scientific response. Clearly, aging has something to do with it, especially as kids approach the senior year in high school. Some of them moderate their drinking, by no means all, but some. There seems to be some fallback when they move to college, when they become freshmen in college. Many kids who matured a bit with their drinking in high school seem to fall backwards when they get to college, but as they become seniors in college, again, they start to drink more responsibly and more moderately. Sometimes it has to do with a goal that they really want to achieve. So it might be that they've discovered that they have an athletic talent and that drinking clearly interferes with that. or they've realized that if they study hard, they could get into a really good university, and they don't want to compromise the ability to do that by either having legal troubles or, you know, detracting from the focus of their athletic practice or college preparation. So sometimes it can be having a really focused goal that's important. And kids who don't have a goal to work towards in school and don't have a strong sense that they could achieve something, they can be the ones that are most in danger.
Most at risk.
I also wanted to say one more thing about kids underestimating the danger of alcohol poisoning, which I think as Kathy brought up.
Yes.
I think this is a particular issue for girls. A number of teenage boys would say that they would make a point of, you know, eating a hamburger before they went to a party so that they weren't drinking on an empty stomach. And girls, because they're concerned about their body image and their weight, tend not to do that. And so girls in particular are in danger of getting into the alcohol poisoning zone. A lot of the stories that we heard of teens who got into quite dangerous situations involve girls. And girls don't drink beer. They prefer to drink spirits mixed with fruity kinds of flavors, and they get drunk much more quickly by doing that.
That's a really good point and an important one. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about teens and drinking, teens and young adults. We're talking with Kathleen Myers and Tisha Miller from the Treatment Research Institute and anthropologist Hugh Gusterson. Tish, I want to talk to you about the population you work with at the Treatment Research Institute. Do you work with a population that is already in trouble? You work with parents of kids who are 12 to 25. So are they in trouble by the time they get to you?
So we work with parents that have kids aged 12 to 25 that are using drugs and or alcohol, and the kid doesn't think it's a problem, doesn't want to get help. We see the parents that come to see us have kids on the entire spectrum from drinking once a month to smoking pot once a month to smoking pot every day to shooting up every day. So it's really the entire range of parents and kids.
Is it a problem? I'm trying to find language here. Is it possible that smoking pot once a month or drinking once a month, is it conceivable that that is not a problem? I'm not talking about 12-year-old. I'm talking about 15, 16-year-old.
Usually when a parent comes to us, there's other things that they're worried about. Oftentimes, it is an indicator of other things that aren't working. And what we really try to do is we have a free service for these parents, because that drug and alcohol use is usually just one thing that is not going well in that child's trajectory. It could be not hanging out with the right people, not able to pay their bills, things of that nature.
So the substance use might not be the problem, but there are other problems there.
It's definitely a symptom.
That's a great point. I think, you know, it's really difficult to say if someone's using once a month, will that be a problem? Because the reality is that parents don't usually know the full extent of use in their teenagers or even in their young adults when they're away at school. So we generally say that what you think is going on is probably the bare minimum, and you need to increase that by a somewhat time significant amount. And how you really differentiate the low frequency users is basically what are the concomitant problems that are going on in this particular youth's life. So how is their school attendance? Is there any signs of any mental health comorbidity? Or have they gotten in trouble with the law? Has their peer group changed? That gives you a sense as to whether frequency is going to be a problem.
When I talk to teenagers, and Hugh, I believe you might have mentioned this in your study. When I talk to teenagers, when I'm the only adult in the room, they tell me they've got extraordinary stress in their lives. That is their first complaint. And the stress they live with is probably worse than the stress any of us had in childhood. And they tell me that alcohol and sex is the only respite they have during the week from all the stress. Did you find that in your study?
I think that's absolutely right. We did a phone poll of teenagers as well as the focus groups, and stress was an issue that kept coming up, and the literature on teen use of alcohol and other substances also keeps talking about stress. I mean, kids not only have to get high grades to get into college and do well these days, but they're expected to do all these extracurricular activities to build up a vita. So you have 15 and 16-year-olds trying to excel at soccer and do charity work and all the rest of it. So at a time when they should be relatively relaxed and enjoying their teenage years, they're actually, really driven, especially by high-achieving parents in some cases.
And so they
look forward to the weekend as a chance to, as they put it, get wasted.
Yeah.
And I think what your listeners should know is that if you get a group of teens together to talk about this and you sort of melt in the background, it becomes clear, I think this is what you just said, that teens look forward to a Saturday night all week. That's what they're thinking of. And alcohol isn't an adjunct to socializing. Alcohol is the focus of the socializing. They can't imagine getting together without alcohol being present.
I do want to add to what you've said, Hugh. You talked about the teenage years. This kind of pressure that you talked about begins in elementary school now. The kids are over-programmed. They're expected to get good grades even in elementary school. So it starts there, and pressure begins before little bodies are able to handle pressure. Let's go to the phone.
I would add to that that schools keep cutting recess.
Yes.
Kids need to run around and burn off energy, and schools no longer cater to that.
Right, right. Let's go to the phones. We've got James on the line. Hi, James.
Hi, Dr. Dan. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
I had a question for you or your guests, and maybe they could answer this either from data and studies or just kind of anecdotally. I'm curious about the long-term effects of children who are allowed, either implicitly or explicitly, to drink underage by their parents, and if there's any kind of long-term effects of that kind of selective rule following, being allowed to break the rules by their parents, if there's any long-term effects of that, later in life.
Kathy?
Yeah, that's a great question, James. And basically, parental provision of drugs and alcohol among the teenage years really increases the risk for later substance use disorders. Parents many times think that they're protecting their child from long-term consequences when, in fact, they're not. The other issue is that there is a growing body of research on the teen brain. And the teen brain remains developing, and it actually into the young adult brain until you're at the age of 25. And the results are showing that there is memory impairment, that the brain is less efficient in processing tasks, so the ability to multitask, do things, multiple things at the same time, which when we think of pressure, that's critical, that kids be able to handle multiple tasks. And that becomes far less efficient in the later adult years. And it's also associated with a variety of cancers. You've got liver cancer, esophageal cancer, breast cancer. So letting your children drink at home is not protective. It really does increase the risk for long-term problems.
Could I come in there with a slightly different perspective, perhaps?
Sure.
Speaking as an anthropologist, one of the things that strikes me is that alcoholism is very low in the Jewish community, and some cultural analysts have suggested the reason for that is the Jewish kids from a young age are given alcohol in ritual contexts at Passover Seders and things like that. On the other hand, rates of alcoholism are very high among children of teetotalers who are not exposed to alcohol at all. So it may be that there are ways that parents can introduce their offspring to alcohol even before the legal drinking age that can in some contexts be protective. And I would just caution that one size doesn't necessarily fit all here. So when you ask about the long-term effects of a parent allowing a child to drink overall underage, I think it depends very much on the nature of that kid, how responsible that kid is, and it depends very much on the kind of drinking we're talking about here, whether it's what we might call binge drinking, or, you know, whether it's a glass of wine with dinner on a Sunday evening or something like that. I was struck a couple of years ago, my wife and I and our kids were at a country pub in England, and we were sitting with someone who was talking to us about his 17-year-old. And then after a few minutes, he pointed to a 17-year-old at another table and said, "That's my son with his friends over there." And I said, "But they're all drinking beer, and they're not of legal age. They're 17 in England. The drinking age is 18. And he said, "Yeah, that's right." And it was the only pub in this village. He said, "Yeah, everyone knows they're 17, but we would rather have them drink out here in front of all the adults where the whole community can watch them. And they know that they don't even get one mistake. They'll never be allowed back again if they get drunk and behave badly. We'd rather that than have them drink at home on their own while I'm here at the pub." And at least on that one evening, the 17-year-olds looked among the quietest, most well-behaved patrons of the
pub. Well, I do have to say I'm watching Kathy listen to you, and her complexion has changed several different colors.
I think, you know, it's interesting. There's a huge debate right now about the risks and benefits of parents providing alcohol, and it sounds like you and I would probably be in one of those debates. I think there's a couple of our colleagues, Erfka Kynak and Amelia Aria, recently did a large systematic review of the literature on parental provision of alcohol. And the weight of evidence is very strong for America. So I can't speak of other countries. Other countries' norms may be different. But for American teenagers, the weight of evidence is that if you provide and allow drugs and alcohol or drinking in your home, that the kids are significantly more likely to drink more when they drink, to drink more often, and to experience substance use problems. Now, obviously, one size doesn't fit all. But I think that the science behind this is pretty conclusive, and such that we're seeing an increase in the number of states who are putting into place social hosting laws. I think states have seen that hosting parties where alcohol is provided by parents to teenagers, they're putting in provisions where you can be held for criminal penalty, between 3 to 6 months in jail, up to a $1,000 fine. They become felonies after repeat offenses. And 41 states have civil liabilities where you are held liable. So, again, one size doesn't fit all, but there is a large weight of evidence showing that parental provision of alcohol is not protective.
We've got to take a break. It does seem that there's a lot more to talk about here and what we need to teach parents and what's healthy and what's not. Tish, when we come back also, I want to hear more about what you do and how you're able to help parents and give parents some guidance about what to say and what not to say. Well, we're talking about teen drinking here on Voices in the Family. My guests are Kathleen Myers and Tish Miller. Both are from the Treatment Research Institute in Philadelphia. I'm also joined on the phone by Hugh Gusterson. He's a professor of anthropology and sociology at George Mason, and he co-conducted the 2010 study, Understanding Teen Drinking Cultures in America. We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499 about discussions you have had or haven't had with your child about alcohol and drugs, and what discussions you might have had when you were growing up with your parents and what you would have liked to have had. 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Do you feel the need to check and recheck constantly? Are you a prisoner of certain rituals and compulsions? Keystone Clinical Studies in Norristown is conducting a research study of an investigational medication for treating obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD. If you're between 18 and 65 and have been diagnosed with OCD, you may be eligible to participate. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about teen drinking today with Kathleen Myers and Tish Miller from the Treatment Research Institute, Hugh Gusterson, and he co-authored Understanding Teen Drinking Cultures in America. You know, before we took our break, Kathy was alluding to social hosting. It's defined as providing and or serving alcohol to a young person who's under the minimum legal drinking age. This tends to take place at the home where there's a gathering of young people and parents are present to a greater or lesser degree. But first, just how hard is it to host a party for young people, one that doesn't feature alcohol? Voices in the Family producer Jennifer Lynn shares a story from a Los Angeles-based attorney and writer Barbara Lodge, who set out to host an alcohol-free party for her 18-year-old son.
I really did believe that kids would be coming into this party happy because it's a summer party, end of summer party. We had so much going on. We had a heated pool and a jacuzzi and games and a ton of food. And I'd be inside. We had six other parents inside having our pizza dinner and watching from the windows. And it would just be really idyllic and innocent. I was really remembering the little kids' parties when they're 13 and 14 and they were just innocent and fun and they played in the pool. Kids' core group of friends, they understood what was important to me and they said, oh, it's going to be great, Mrs. Lodge. We'll make sure nobody does anything wrong. It got really big, and some of the parents in the kitchen were concerned that it was getting too big. And I looked at it as, wow, this is such a positive party because people know there's no drugs, no alcohol. The police came, and I'm watching, and all of a sudden, the kids start screaming out the side gate, sort of like an exodus. They're just calmly walking and leaving, and I'm thinking in my naivety, wait, what's going on? Why is everybody leaving? They had some sort of psychic ability to understand that the police were there. So then the police took me by the arm to the backyard, and that's when I saw it had been completely the opposite of what I had imagined it was. First thing I saw was an empty backyard covered, littered in cans and bottles, alcohol, and it was unbelievable. And I was thinking, how did all this get there? Then one of the two officers walked to the back, there was this little back house, opened the door, and literally a white cloud of marijuana came billowing out, and about eight or nine more kids scattered like cockroaches because they're just looking around like insects and then they just literally run out of my property and the police knew and they're like, how could you let this happen? How didn't you know people were in the back? Pretty much, what kind of a mother are you? How could you let this happen? I was duped.
Los Angeles-based blogger Barbara Lodge recently wrote about her effort to host this party. Her post appears in the New York Times Motherlode column dated June 9th of this year. Here's a postscript. Barbara was extremely worried about what would happen to the kids who attended the party. Luckily, no one was injured or severely sickened as a result of the gathering, but she did talk to her son, and he said, but Mom, everybody drinks. So, that gets to one of the questions I raised at the beginning of the show. What is normal? What's average? Hugh, let's start with you. What is typical teenage drinking? Is there such a thing?
Well, I really want to get away from the notion of normal. I think that parents have to figure out who their kid or kids are. You know, we structure our study around these different roles of abstainers, fairly moderate drinkers, partiers, and losers. And you have to figure out who your kid is. And if your kid is a partier, you want to deal with them very differently than if they're an abstainer or a moderate drinker. If I could, before we move on, I did just want to say one more thing about the social hosting issue. You know, it's a very vexed issue. And when you see teens dying, either of alcohol poisoning or because of drunk driving, you want to take really strong, decisive action. And if I can be permitted, as a foreign anthropologist who's lived in America for over 30 years, I think there's a kind of cultural reflex in American culture of, you know, zero tolerance. We're going to stamp this out. We're going to come down hard, social deterrence. And it's a reason why America has 10% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prison population. We incarcerate a higher percentage of our population than any other country in the world, including China and Russia. And I think it comes down to this cultural reflex of, you know, just say no and so on. And many of those people are in jail for, you know, substance abuse issues. So there are dangers in these new social hosting laws. And if I can just briefly tell the most horrifying anecdote I heard in my research was from a focus group that was conducted just 100 miles away from Philadelphia in a middle-class neighborhood where they had laws that you were fined for every kid in your house who was found drinking alcohol. And in this focus group, there were three kids who'd been at a party in someone's house. The parents were engaged in social hosting in what I regard as a very irresponsible way. They were upstairs, the kids were in the basement, they weren't monitoring the kids or anything. And a girl who had very little experience drinking drank a lot, mixed a lot of different things. She passed out, she was throwing up, her heartbeat was doing strange things, her temperature was fluctuating. And the kids got terrified and they called the father down. And he came downstairs, and he knew that if he called 911, which is what he should have done, he was looking at thousands and thousands of dollars in fines. And so he didn't. He didn't call 911. And that's one of the dangers of these social hosting laws, that people will not get help for people when they need to because they'll be terrified of going to jail or paying thousands of dollars in fines.
And I think it's a good point, but I also think that what we're starting to see around the country are some Good Samaritan laws. And so there a number of states are passing laws that if you do call 911 under those circumstances, because it is the difference between life and death, and many people don't want to get into trouble, that you will not be held you can have criminal penalties with you, and in some there may even be civil penalties. So I agree. And I think, you know, this is a tough topic. Adolescent drinking, adolescent drug use is a tough topic. But at no other time in development, in our human development, are we at more risk for developing a substance use disorder. And so I think that certainly, you can't really predict at age 12, 13 who's going to use. But if you start to drink under the age of 15, you're five times more likely to develop a substance use disorder in adulthood. So I just want to caution. I understand where you're coming from and a lot of that, and that one size doesn't fit all. But I also want to caution that we can't minimize drinking, even when it is not very, very frequent, because there are a lot of physiological changes.
Let me turn to you, Tish. I've let you off the hook for a good part of the show, so I'll let you have the hard questions. Is anything acceptable? Is anything okay? Is everything a matter of concern?
So I'm not speaking as a scientist. I'm speaking as a therapist. Wow, that's a really hard question. I don't want to answer that yes or no. I think what the biggest thing that I think is important is that the parent has an ongoing, the context is important. The parent has an ongoing discussion with the kid, and there's that honesty about it. It depends on the circumstance. It depends. Some kids are more receptive to drug, to problems later on because of genetics, because of stresses in the home, things of that nature. So I'm not really answering your question.
No, I know. But I guess here's my concern.
Okay.
And you can help with this.
Okay.
We want to open a dialogue, right?
Yeah.
And if we parents come in with the attitude and position that any drinking is at risk, no drinking is acceptable, there are consequences for any drinking, that cuts off all conversation. Then you get a head nod from the kid and say, okay, mom or dad, and then that's it. That's end of discussion.
And you're right. That's a really difficult line. Lots of times parents will say, you know what? I don't ever want you drinking. I don't ever want you doing drugs. But if you are drinking or using drugs, if you call me, there's going to be no questions asked. There will be, I just want you to get home safe. It's, I think it needs to be in the context of the family history of drug and alcohol use. I think it needs to be in the context of, you know, I see that your peers are doing this, rather than, there is research that says you should do a hard line and saying absolutely no drug and alcohol use. My thought is the biggest prevention of drug and alcohol use is an open dialogue with the child from this big.
Yeah, there's a reason why young people run away from organized religion. It's the same thing. I mean, here's the way you should behave in the way, and here's what you shouldn't.
And I think that's a great point. Part of it is the parent doesn't know what it's like when the child is in that peer situation. So say, hey, I wonder, what is it like for you when you went to that party, that after school party, were people asking you for drugs, you know, if you wanted to drink or not? I'm just curious. And the kid may say, no, that doesn't happen. And to be like, well, I'd imagine it would. Like, I wonder, how would you even approach that? How would you say that? Do people think that you're a loser if you don't drink? Or kind of just having the child know that it is an open discussion.
If I could add one little thing to that, I think it often helps to ask kids about other kids at parties instead of about their own experience.
Absolutely.
And their own behavior. They can often talk more openly about what a friend of theirs, who might be known to the parents as well, did at a party, and that can provide an opening to finally talk about your own kids.
Tisha, what's your take about sharing your own history?
I think that there's no need to share an appropriate history. It's kind of, you know, similar to how much does a parent need to share their experience with their history of their sex life. You know, you need to tell them what's age appropriate, what's important, but let them know, you know, yeah, I have made a few mistakes. One of the things that you have to be careful of with that is that the kid will say, well, you know, like mom experimented and she's fine. So I think part of it is you can share some of that. Don't lie.
And what's your take about sharing the good news about drugs and alcohol?
Can you expand a little bit?
Oh, easily. They work. They cut down on stress. They make you feel good. You feel more connected. You're not worried about your problem. That's the good news. They work. And my concern with my kids is I told them the good news, because if I didn't tell them the good news, they would go out and get high and feel great, and then they just consider me, you know, a liar or, you know, a typical parent. I told them the good news about drugs and alcohol. I told them the good news about sex.
Absolutely. You need to be upfront. There is, if you say, oh, they're all bad, well, then why is everyone doing it? One great and horrible things about alcohol and drugs is it works, and it works fast, and it's efficient. So, yeah, I think giving them a realistic picture versus the, you know, scared straight type of picture is really important, because the kids are going to know.
Yeah, and it's, I think one of the things that we do at the family training program is that we ask kids, we do what we call functional analysis of behavior, and one of the things are, what are the problems that have been related to drug use, but also what are the pros, what are the things that you get out of drug use, with the hope that we can find less risky ways to gain those positives. So, you know, it is an excellent point.
Mm-hmm. We've got to take a short break. We've got several callers who want to join the conversation, and I want to talk about the larger cultural issues, too. We're talking about teen alcohol use and abuse and substance abuse. My guests are Kathleen Myers and Tisha Miller. They're from the Treatment Research Institute here in Philadelphia. I'm also joined on the phone by Hugh Gusterson. He's a professor of anthropology and sociology at George Mason University. I should mention that Treatment Research Institute is a funder here at WHYY, and we're glad to have them on board. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'll be back after a very short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Do you feel the need to check and recheck constantly? Are you a prisoner of certain rituals and compulsions? Keystone Clinical Studies in Norristown is conducting a research study of an investigational medication for treating obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. If you're between 18 and 65 and have been diagnosed with OCD, you may be eligible to participate. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about teen drinking with Kathleen Myers, Tisha Miller, and Hugh Gusterson. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Valerie on the line. Hi, Valerie.
Hello. I have two questions. You've actually answered a couple of other ones, but the two questions I have are, first of all, we've got people from all over the world as parents coming to the United States who really are not familiar with our cultural norms and how to have discussions with their largely Americanized children. And also, do you have resources that people can look up online about how to have these discussions? You've come up with some good ideas, but I think that a lot of parents could use some further guidance around how to start and continue discussions where the children will continue to be honest and authentic.
Well, I think maybe one of the best resources in town about how to have these discussions is sitting right across from me at the desk. So can you answer Valerie's question, Tisha, about, A, how do you know when a child's having problems, and how do we really have these discussions?
I'm pausing because that's a big question. You have these discussions all along. I think that Hugh made... Oh, go
when
ahead.
When do they start? How do they start?
They start as young as possible. They start when, you know, things happen in the news and you talk about that. That's a window of opportunity to be able to talk about, you know, this star from Glee just died.
Corey Monteith.
Yeah. What do you think is going on there? Why do you think he's using drugs and alcohol? It's something that I encourage parents to talk as soon as possible about it. And be open with them. Like, I think you made a great point, Dan, about how it is alluring. There are positive effects to it. What was the other question?
What resources are around? How do we know when our child's in trouble?
So one of the best resources for anyone is drugfree.org. This is a website that is set up by the Partnership for Drug-Free America, and in collaboration with actually TRI. But what it does is it talks to parents how to talk to your kid, at what age, depending on what stage your child is on. The thing that I really love about this particular website, and I've done a lot of looking for websites that I can give to parents, is it'll give you role plays. This is what you should talk to your child about. It's very, very informative, and it's on all the entire spectrum. In terms of right here in Philadelphia or the tri-state area, part of what Treatment Research Institute has is called the Family Training Program. We are funded by National Institute on Drug Abuse.
What do you do?
Great question. I like how you just cut
that,
to it.
That one you can answer.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can, and I will. So we provide free one-on-one counseling, training, information for parents that have kids that are using drugs and alcohol aged 12 to 25. And again, this can be a kid that's just started to use alcohol or is using it very frequently. And what we do is we utilize, we call the parents the agent of change, because the kid doesn't think it's a problem. But the parent says, you know what, maybe this may be a problem, or it may develop into a problem. And we use the relationship with the parent and try to work on the dynamics between the child and the parent to get some sort of shifts in that relationship that may equal out to the child being more open or more receptive to getting some help, reduction or lack of drug use, and also just to help the parent have sanity about it. The one thing I want to say also is that even though the focus is on drugs and alcohol use, all of the skills that we're teaching these parents are applicable to any behavior. It's basic skills.
Spoken like a true family therapist. I want to.
I could put in a little plug for the funder of our George Mason study. The Century Council at centurycouncil.org has a number of resources on how to talk to teenagers about drinking. I'm looking at their website, and Girl Talk is their featured initiative right now, how to talk to teenage girls about this.
Give us that website again, Hugh.
www.centurycouncil.org.
Hugh, in your report, you've got something called the Framework for Community Action. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a multifaceted problem, teenage drinking. It's not just a problem within families. I think teenage drinking thrives on silence, and that silence comes from many directions. It often comes from parents, as Trish and Kathy were saying, but it also comes from schools. It comes from churches. And so I think we need to think in terms of a multi-pronged solution to the problem. You need people in churches to be talking to kids about drinking. You need teachers to be talking about it. I'm struck that my 11-year-old son in health education has been told about marijuana, but not about alcohol. His school is not telling him about alcohol. It takes a village, I guess, to get a kid not to drink or not to drink dangerously.
Yeah, and Kathy, we also need resources in the community. I mean, you know, we talked earlier, where do these kids go to socialize? All they've got is a party. And you know, I spoke to one young man from Temple, and he said, you know, if I take my girlfriend to the movie, just to the movie, it's $40. Yeah. And if I go to a fraternity party, I get all the beer I want for $5. I mean, we just don't have resources in our community for these kids.
Yeah, that's very true. And we're hoping over time that communities will develop different types of community centers that used to thrive years ago so that kids can go and have sober fun. And I think, you know, one last thing for any of your listeners, is the social media has fueled problems. You know, kids learn from other kids on social media. And, you know, you hear things about there's now the vodka or alcohol and tampons, and you can smoke alcohol. And so if parents, you know, one of the things that we need to encourage parents to do is to monitor their kids' behavior.
Well, I mean, that's part of the theme is monitoring, monitoring and stay close. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank all three of you. It's been such an important show and I think an enlightening one too. Kathleen, Tish, thanks you very much.
Thanks for having us.
And Hugh, thank you. And thanks for the work all three of you are doing. I want to close by sharing some sad news with you. All of us here at Voices were saddened by the news of the death of Pennsylvania attorney Dennis Hagerty. He lived his life changing the world for special people with mental and physical disabilities. His work actually created the Right to Education Act and other important legislation, not only in Pennsylvania, but around the country. In this interview with Visionary Voices Project at Temple University, Hagerty recalls the difficulties he faced as a parent in the 1950s raising a son with an intellectual disability.
When he was about 4 years old, I took him to the local pharmacy to buy hairspray for my wife. And when he went in the place, he got loose from me. And before I knew it, he had wiped out all the perfumes on the second row, and they were all over the floor. And the pharmacist, Mr. Pepper, came out and was very patient. And I thought, oh, my God, this is going to cost me a bunch of money. And he was very quiet and patient and said, your boy's retarded, isn't he? And I said, yes. He said, have you ever heard of the Retarded Citizens Association? I said, no. He said, we have one in every county in Pennsylvania at a state level. And I'd like you to introduce you if you would like to do that. I said, perfect, I'd love to. Because I was looking forward to some education for my child, and finding none except in church basements where they might have a babysitting operation. And I thought anything would be better than nothing.
That was Dennis Hagerty, father of the Right to Education Act. He left the world a better place. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about the quantified self movement. Well, comment on today's show by going to whyy.org/voices. You can download this or other Voices shows there. And we're on Twitter at Voices in the Fam, and I am at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Hannah DeStefano is our summer intern. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Oh, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.